Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Virtually at this moment, 100 days ago, that the polls in the New South Wales election closed, and very soon after it was evident that Barry O'Farrell would become Premier. It's great to have Mr. O'Farrell back at the Sydney Institute. This is his third appearance here. The first one was way back in 1999, and most recently last year, where from memory he spoke about the issue of trust. And tonight the Premier is going to address the Sydney Institute on valuing people and the reform of New South Wales public services. Mr. O'Farrell, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Jared. Turning up early had a couple of advantages. We got to hear about Jared's background as a Hoyt Sacherette. I would love to have seen the outfit. And secondly, we saw Jared do an impersonation of Edna Everidge, for those people who are wide awake. Jared, member of the Sydney Institute, in my last address here, I talked about the importance of trust in government. I argued, amongst other things, that it was people, not governments, that created civil society. I'd add my belief that Westminster tradition and the process that was established in the 19th century are in fact our strongest resource to take the New South Wales public service into a brand new era of innovation. And that responsive and innovative governments are the expression of good people, because public administrations can't do their best if we forget that public service is the sum of individual contributions and the quality of public sector leadership. So as we approach our first 100 days in office, my government's championed good people and merit in reshaping our public service to meet contemporary challenges. I'd like to thank Jared and the Sydney Institute for again allowing me the opportunity to speak here. I want to thank him on this occasion for the opportunity to speak about the significance of people, of good people, in restoring good government to New South Wales. For much of the last 16 years, hard-working citizens across New South Wales have been let down by a failure of political leadership to articulate a strong direction and clear priorities. Despite the energy of our citizens and our natural and intellectual resources, families and businesses have had to work even harder to reach their goals because previous political leadership failed to map a pathway that provided people with freer choices. In establishing a plan to restore New South Wales' fortunes, to make us number one again, the New South Wales Liberals and Nationals drew up an action plan that we believed reflected people's aspirations: growing our economy, improving our services, renovating our infrastructure, restoring honesty to government, and giving people a greater say in decision making. An action plan that was supported by detailed policies. And on March 27, the day after the election campaign, we faced the reality of a $5 billion plus black hole, a public service battered by scapegoating and murky political deal-making, and a roadmap, if there ever was one, whose pathway had been corrupted, dead-ended, or trashed by political deal-makers more focused on their own fortunes than those of the people they represented. The 2.1 million people who voted for change in New South Wales, 700,000 of whom voted Liberal National for the first time, along with others across this nation who know the importance of a vibrant New South Wales to the national economy, wanted us to get on and fix the mess in this state. Now, business schools are full of case studies of CEOs inheriting basket cases. Management academics like Jim Collins have made careers in writing books about hedgehogs and putting people on the bus, and I'm sure there are people here who've actually bothered to read them. Now, public administration and military engineering don't always sustain comparison. But as someone who's fascinated by our rich Australian history, I'd prefer to draw on the experience of an engineer who in 1908 accepted the command of the Victorian section of the Australian Intelligence Corps, the citizen soldier General Sir John Monash. For a corps whose bread and butter was knowledge of the places in which they might have defended Australia, Monash was shocked to discover they actually had no maps whatsoever. No maps of Australia, let alone maps of those areas of the world in which Australia's strategic interests would play out. And Monash, confronted with that situation, knew that the answer started with good people. He immediately tackled his own self-described basket case by selecting a staff of 15 specialists to do the necessary jobs. People who were educated, courteous and dedicated, people who were prepared to get their hands dirty, literally, in his own terms. And he set them to work in what he described as a collegiate atmosphere. His team included scientists, engineers, logisticians, librarians, and of course accountants to try and ensure that the books balanced. Monash took the initiative and invested in looking beyond the immediate horizon. He sought to understand the risks and the competition ahead. And of course he got on and created those maps, sending his people out on bicycles across the countryside to draw them themselves. These earlier responses by Monash helped establish the capability to win a bigger battle, the victory in Europe, for which Australians under his leadership deserve enormous praise. And what inspires me about Monash is that when he was confronted with a fundamentally awful problem, he knew immediately that the way to fix it was to assemble a great team of good people. Blaming the system or surrendering to the status quo, he knew, wasn't the answer. So he took the initiative in the best Australian way, a can-do approach that also respected the best military tradition, underpinning the ingenuity and innovation of his team. There is only one good thing about opposition, as I'm sure Terry Sheen can almost attest to, and that's the opportunity it provides to do your homework, to think about ways to do things better. And from the depths of opposition, and they were very deep at times, my team knew that if we were to be successful and implement our policies, if elected to government, we'd be relying on a public service whose detailed workings were largely obscure to us. Our then shadow cabinet knew it would be good people, more than any new systems, that would be the difference between meeting community expectations and delivering more of the same. A lot's happened since the people of New South Wales voted for real change 100 days ago, and in the 93 days since my government was sworn in. And over this time we've come face to face with the men and women of a state administration that until March 27th was only an oblique reflection in the mirror of opposition. And the observations, prejudices and assumptions made over 16 years have to be confronted, interrogated, accepted or rejected. Because regardless of who'd caused the problems, it was up to us not only to fix it, but to own it. Of all the messages we received from voters, the clearest was, we know it's stuffed, just get on and fix it. And I wasn't disappointed. My impression of those first few days was of a professional people bringing expert advice to my team and I on how our detailed agenda could be implemented. I was doubly inspired because I could see that what I knew was an ambitious agenda could be achieved with a team of professionals who were hungry for direction and keen to roll up their sleeves and, in Monash's words, get their hands dirty. Now, people have high expectations of us, rightly have high expectations of us, and high expectations of their public service. After all, it costs $27.7 billion a year in salaries, and with 7.2 million people across this state, that means an annual outlay of the equivalent of $3,800 for every man, woman and child across New South Wales. Our core business in government is meeting the needs that markets or others can't or won't meet. And to deliver on behalf of citizens those things which people delegate in very limited ways to us, to do on their behalf. Regulation, compliance, public infrastructure, and certain services. Meeting those needs demands good people designing and managing the systems to procure, to implement, and evaluate them. So it is all about people. And since governments generally don't manufacture things, our policy, services, and regulatory responsibilities require that our assets, to adopt the management jargon, are the people who are employed. Around 322,000 public sector assets walk in the door of state agencies every day. But it's troubled me that too often our public service is characterised as a faceless cohort, an anonymous workforce, a group for whom one approach apparently fits all. I believe it demeans and undervalues the uniqueness of each employee and the contribution they make to this state. When someone's treated in a hospital or suffers a robbery, the patient or the victim generally praises to friends and families the individual nurse or officer whose attention, whose care actually made the difference. The senior constable who performed his job with dispassionate and consummate professionalism a few weeks ago in the so-called Burka incident deserves our praise for his handling of the situation. Individuals in public service, like Constable Fogarty, and others in challenging and unpredictable frontline situations, set the tone of trust and dependability upon which our civil domain relies. And it's the only basis upon which we can sustain the mature and honest democracy in which we live. So I think it's a shame that for too long the idea of individuals in our public service has been obscured. By contrast, very large and customer-oriented organisations like Bunnings and McDonald's, the latter of which I had some association with a few years ago, proudly celebrate their outstanding individuals with Employee of the Month or similar accolades in their store entrances. In the same spirit, I'd like us to be more focused on developing and rewarding individuals across our public sector, who, as in the business and not-for-profit sectors, contribute value and reputation in the eyes of customers, stakeholders, and shareholders. And that's because, in my view, the logical way to motivate outstanding innovation in customer service to citizens is to foster a public service in which individuals are truly visible and meaningful, regardless of the size of the team of which they're a part. Now, governments are measured on many milestones, and our 100-day action plan is one on which I welcome scrutiny next Tuesday. Our action plan set out to deliver, for instance, the creation of bodies such as Infrastructure New South Wales or Destination New South Wales. It set out to commence the commission of audit and the review of the state's planning system. It set out to put in place desperately needed budget control, a start on the vital infrastructure we need, like the Northwest Rail Link and the convention centre that we plan for Sydney, and of course the restoration of honesty and trust in government with measures to strengthen ICAC, the public sector and ministerial ethics framework, to end taxpayer-funded political advertising, to include tax relief, whether payroll tax relief to create 100,000 new jobs across the state, or the abolition of Labor's home buyers tax, or the empty nesters stamp duty. And of course, it was all about trying to put downward pressure on cost of living, with the Tambling inquiry into electricity, not only to get to the bottom of Labor's power sell-off, but to set a future course for the state. I'm pleased to report that our action plan is on track. It's enabled us to deliver some priorities whilst the groundwork commenced for our other commitments, which will be delivered in part through the September 6 budget. And whilst there's no dispute from any quarter that we inherited a financial basket case, it's been my express direction to bureaucrats and ministers that we will honour our promises and reflect these as priorities in our next and in our following budgets. If we can do nothing else over this term except deliver on the promises we made at the 2011 election, we'll have achieved more than a government has in this state for 20 years. And that's to say we're not going to allow Labor's $5 billion plus black hole get in the way of delivering those critical services we pledged ourselves to deliver. I'm proud of the state we've been able to, of the start we've been able to make. I'm proud of the time that my team invested in opposition planning transition priorities that would be vital in the event we were successful. And that included policy implementation and costing, drafting of outlines of key legislation, detailed structural thinking, and most important of all, understanding that getting the people right in the right places would be crucial to our success. So let me focus on two aspects of delivering our action plan. One, outstanding people in public sector leadership, and two, combining the traditions of Westminster with leading edge innovation. I was amused before the election to read histrionic predictions by some commentators that a New South Wales Liberals and Nationals victory would lead to a night of the long knives, decimating the upper echelons of the public service, followed by a tsunami of partisan appointments as we sought to shoehorn into jobs people who are members of the Liberal National parties. Those commentators failed to understand that our vision for the restoration of a professional public service which valued integrity and Westminster tradition is exactly what we intended and what we are going to deliver. When I told the Institute of Public Administration of Australia in June last year that any public servant who wants to be part of our reformist agenda wants to use their skills to deliver the reliable quality services our citizens deserve, wants to help secure the state's future, whether prosperity or whether opportunities, that they would be welcomed, whatever their background, whatever their history was, I actually meant it. And I don't apologise to the commentariat for getting wrong, because I understand that after 16 years of Labor government, they thought the norm in government was to do precisely what they're accusing us of doing. But the appointment of Chris Eccles, for instance, as Director General of the Department of Premier and Cabinet, proved our intention to restore genuine Westminster public administration to the state. Mr. Eccles represents a new generation of professional public servants, combining a public service, public sector career in Victoria, Queensland, South Australia and Canberra with experience in the private sector, law and in vocational skills and training. For those of you who don't know, he was last employed as the South Australian Labor Premier Mike Rans, Director General of his Department of Premier and Cabinet. For me, it's about what they can do. It's about the skills they have, not who they've worked for or how they vote. It's a combination of experience that Chris Eccles has that I believe is well suited to lead the New South Wales Public Service to respond rapidly to the demand for a better customer focus, for accountability and the acute and diverse service delivery modes that our community increasingly seeks. We recognise existing professional skill and talents in other key appointments and align those skills with our new departmental cluster structures, with Michael Coutts-Trotter appointed to head up the new large Department of Finance and Services. We've attracted outstanding expertise to the role of Director General of Health, with Dr. Mary Foley being appointed. And a former federal departmental head, Mark Patterson, has taken up the role of Director General of the Department of Trade, Investment, Regional Infrastructure and Services. We advertise worldwide for a new Secretary of the Treasury as well as a Director General of Education, because we're determined to see who is out there who wants to join our reformist government to deliver the best possible services in both of those critical areas. The new CEO of Infrastructure New South Wales, Paul Broad, brings a mix of public sector and private sector infrastructure and utilities experience to a infrastructure project selection, finance and delivery task that is perhaps the greatest that the state has to deliver. And I'm pleased to announce today that Cabinet approved the appointment of Yasmin King as New South Wales' first Small Business Commissioner. Ms. King's expertise includes economics, finance, arbitration and non-executive directorships. She was an Associate Commissioner of the ACCC, and she's had direct experience with small business and micro-business through her own family companies. As Small Business Commissioner, she'll champion the interests of that sector in government policy and ensure that the concerns of small businesses, the engine room of jobs growth across our economy, are not monstered by big bureaucracy who at times can be deaf or insensitive to their needs. I want to make sure that we do or not do whatever we can to enable business to thrive, innovate, employ, export and compete. And I look forward to Ms. King being brought under the saddle of government and government agencies to make that happen. Ms. King was appointed from a competitive field of applicants, again, in response to the public advertising of a senior position, something that for too long in this state has not routinely occurred. These outstanding individuals add to the continuing CEOs who have accepted and embraced the chance to respond to our new agenda and are producing exciting ideas, many of which have been sidelined under previous administrations. We look to our public service leaders, as well as to the middle and frontline public sector workers, for a healthy and constructive tension that preserves the public interest, defends public value, and adds professional quality and value to the commitments of an elected government. In other words, we look to them for frank and fearless advice of the first quality. Over the last 93 days, my staff have on occasions complained and been indignant when my department set up advice that basically said no. But if the department's view was evidence-based, if it reflected the best policy options, it was advice that I was happily prepared to accept, because frankly, that's their job, and it's the job I want the public sector to deliver to us. A centrepiece of our public service policy is the establishment of a public service commission, and the appointment of Professor Peter Shergold signals again that we're serious about building the integrity, professionalism, innovation, independence and capability of our public service and the individuals who seek or who currently work within it. Recruitment for the position of commissioner was launched 3 weeks ago, and we expect the public service commission to be operational within the next few months. And in our own ministerial staffing arrangements, we were determined to recruit on the basis of merit and capability. And if you heard whisperings about a star chamber, they were true. An independent panel that put candidates through a rigorous examination to ensure that ministers had a quality pool of individuals to consider, and taxpayers could be sure that merit underpinned appointments, even political appointments, in ministerial offices. And we put an end to any nepotism within ministerial offices by ensuring that any such applicants who are related to my colleagues have to go through an independent process. I said at the outset that Westminster traditions and processes established in the 19th century are our strongest resource to take the New South Wales public service into a brand new era of innovation. Maybe we could call it Westminnovation. A bit like incentivation, Jared. I don't think it'll fly. The New South Wales Liberals and Nationals honour the institutions of parliamentary democracy. We're reinstating Westminster processes, green papers, white papers, proper cabinet processes, genuine question times, a restoration of petitions being read out, and even restoring a working committee system to the Parliament. But it's not to say that we're conservative or resist innovation. On the contrary, it's by honouring the institutions of an independent public service and the maturity of its systems and unique specialisations that we have a solid foundation from which we can confidently innovate. And, of course, innovation sometimes means taking risks. Now, risk is good if assessed stringently and with tolerance for failure within predetermined acceptable limits. You simply can't make these assessments if your fundamentals aren't well grounded. We'll encourage individuals across the public sector to innovate with the confidence of good strategic planning, asking themselves, why are we doing this and what will success look like? The right skills, asking themselves, are they the best and are they relevant? An honest evaluation, did we get it right? Is there a better way to do it? How do we overcome the mistakes we've made? None of this can succeed if the public service is politicised, unfocused, demoralised, and without relevant incentive or clear direction. Our first step in Westminster-enabled innovation was to implement improved structural efficiencies, and that's why we have departmental clusters focused on clear strategic priorities. It's why I gave ministers and director generals unambiguous accountabilities and working relationships. It's why we have a centre whole of government strategic policy and regulatory overview within the Department of Premier and Cabinet. It's why clusters were shaped to force stronger relationship between agencies with close collaborative imperatives, and it's also why we've created clear budget accountability at a cluster level. Many private sector CEOs report to shareholders and must have the flexibility to allocate scarce and valuable resources to the priorities its customers and shareholders want. The public service shouldn't be any different. Taxpayers deserve to have confidence that the $27.7 billion spent each year on public sector salaries returns the highest quality and the highest value possible. Regrettably, the last 16 years have seen political masters advance their selfish party interests while taxpayers fork out more and more but in return receive less and less. Senior bureaucrats have been hamstrung by past political manipulation, which prevented them from putting the right people in the necessary places or the correct jobs. If we're to expect public sector CEOs to deliver on their KPIs, they must have the flexibility and autonomy to deploy their people and acquire the necessary skills to do those jobs. And Labor's learned nothing, because when we actually resolved to implement a perfectly sensible wages policy they put in place in 2007, but ignored in practice, their imagination was limited to reciting Jurassic slogans and making a spectacle of the upper house for the first time in however long it's been around. So in addition to confirming wages policy to help bring New South Wales finances under control, we also abolished Labor's feared of no forced redundancy policy, so that employees who for whatever reason are without a job, who can't within a certain period find a job within the public sector, are then assisted to depart. It's a policy that exists in other Labor states, but it was prevented from existing here because of the cosy and rotten relationship between the former state Labor government and the public sector unions. So for New South Wales Liberals and Nationals government, what matters will be the shape, not size, of government and the outcomes it delivers to citizens, customers, and the value it delivers to taxpayers. Taxpayers and battling businesses around the state are right to expect that government respect the real pressures and costs that drive them, and don't create at their own expense a public sector environment out of touch with all reality. Now, many people will remember when aspirants for a public service career used to do an exam. I know that when I was accepted into the graduate trainee program in Canberra too many decades ago to remember, unless you're Gerard Henderson, there was an exam involved. Gerard's probably still got the file somewhere. The test created a real sense of pride in those who met the standards. It defined a public service career as prestigious and a competitive choice. In thinking about how to attract a new generation of best and brightest of the public service, I wonder perhaps if there's something to be gained by revisiting Westminster tradition and adapting the values to achieving our contemporary objectives, to define the public service as an admired and competitive career choice, to develop a cadre of young professional thinkers, and once again have a broad community view that success in entry to a public service career is a prestigious outcome for any individual. Now, I'm certainly not suggesting we go back to colonial times and test on history or Latin. We want to recruit widely and not put in place clunky barriers to entry. Our objective is to get the right people in the right places to deliver the right results for people. So the contemporary version of what we used to know as public service exam could be to rethink our recruitment and interview practices to emphasise selection of our best and brightest individuals who are innovators, customer-focused, outcome and devolution oriented. We have much to learn from employers such as those big consulting firms who compete with us for talented people and who put their entrance for employment through precisely those tests. When the Public Service Commission is up and running, I hope the prospect of upgrading our recruitment methodologies to define the high standards of a world-class, innovative and contemporary public service might be considered amongst the many reform ideas that I look forward to seeing emerge from that body. In conclusion, Gerard, John Monash needed new maps, and so metaphorically does New South Wales. And I'll say more about this in coming days, but it's important to have a plan for 1,380 days of this term of Parliament, as it has been to have a plan for the first 100 days. I was told by John Key before I was elected that change of government brings with it an energy that you have to withstand. An energy that, if you don't have a clear direction, will push you from pillar to post, and you'll get to the end of the 100 days without having achieved much at all. That was the importance of the 100 days. A map or a forward plan is central in establishing trust across the civil domain and to evaluating success or failure. A good map articulates a journey and the targets that are to be reached. For New South Wales, overwhelmingly, that map sets a sight on being number one again. Delivering our policies and achieving the service results and objectives overwhelmingly demanded by the citizens by their vote in March requires us to bring the imagination and capability of every single individual in the New South Wales public sector together to make the best use of every single taxpayer dollar. We'll look to the front line, the middle and the senior ranks, for ideas and experience to bring choice and contestability to public services, to work with the private and not-for-profit sectors to find ways to devolve decisions and decision-making processes as closely as possible to the people they affect in the areas in which they're delivered, to make government more transparent and accountable, and to put the citizen, the customer, the taxpayer, again at the centre of public services. We have to use the strength of our Westminster traditions to give people confidence to try new ideas and extend beyond our comfort zone in rapidly developing challenges. And in doing so, we must enable individuals in the public service to draw their own lines on that map and be acknowledged for their contribution to the quality of life and for the opportunities that exist here in New South Wales. Thank you.
Are we here or are we here?
Thank you. Stand there. Do you want to pass the
mic? I'll do it.
Many thanks, Mr. Premier. I should also thank the Four Seasons Hotel for cooperating and being very helpful in setting up this function tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock and we don't have a lot of time, so we'll move quickly. Premier, it's around this time, 100 days ago, that it was now clear that you were going to be Premier of New South Wales. You've gone back a bit on the period since the election. In the next couple of weeks, you've probably got some important discussions with the Prime Minister and the government in Canberra about a carbon tax leading to an emissions trading scheme. What's your feeling on that from what you and the rest of us know already about the likely impact on such places as the Hunter and the Illawarra, key parts of New South Wales?
Well, we know from a future economics study that the Hunter stands to lose something like 13,000 jobs if a carbon tax comes in. I have to say, as Premier of a state in which our manufacturing sector has been reduced significantly, a carbon tax that will not just affect one steel out at Rudy Hill or BlueScope down in the Illawarra, but will have an impact on any manufacturing facility in New South Wales, will have a significant impact in both the Hunter and the Illawarra regions in terms of loss of jobs, and will have an impact across the entire state in terms of increased prices, not just for electricity, but for other things as well, is of concern. It's why I've written to the Prime Minister seeking a briefing when we get to Carrag on the 15th of July as to what is proposed. This idea that you slice the salami slowly in trying to deliver what would be a massive shock to the national economy in implementing a carbon tax is simply hopeless. Today they couldn't even answer a simple question as to whether the carbon tax will apply to the fuel that goes in our public transport buses. If it does, that's bus fares up. If it doesn't, it'd be nice as a state government to know.
Premier, Mike Zorbas from Stockland. There has been over the last, I think it's fair to say, 12 months, a lazy and at times disingenuous discussion at the federal level about population growth. I'd be keen to hear your view on population growth in New South Wales and what, if anything, we can do as a state to plan adequately for that growth.
Stockland's still building units, are they? I believe people are assets. There have been assets for the 223 years that Europeans first arrived here and have been coming out. Thankfully, these days we come from all corners of the world. There have been assets for the tens of thousands of years in which Aboriginal Australians occupied these lands. However they get here, they are assets. And so what I know I can't influence is, well, what I know I can't control is the federal government's immigration policy. Although I will say that at a time when economies like Greece, like Ireland, like Spain and Portugal are struggling, wouldn't it be a great thing if New South Wales and Australia were over there encouraging people to come to this country in the same way as we did 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago? Now, there are opportunities out there. They might be assets. Everyone's an asset. but there's some opportunities out there to rescue people, to give people the opportunities this country has always afforded. So for me, it's not about the immigration policy. We have to live with whatever cloth the federal government cuts. I think the saddest part of last year's federal election campaign was the spectre of a Prime Minister out in Western Sydney blaming immigration and population growth for the state of infrastructure in the western part of the city. You know, that wasn't the cause of that wasn't due to population growth and immigration. It was due to the failure of government to do what governments have always done in this state, which is match infrastructure to the growth in population. That's what drove JJC Bradfield to plan and deliver the Harbour Bridge, a view about the growth that this city was going to have. That's been forgotten. That's why we have infrastructure in New South Wales in place. The difference we bring to it is we're determined to develop the whole of New South Wales. That's why we put in place regional relocation grants, to try and ensure that through, supported by our Jobs Action Plan, supported by infrastructure spend, that if people want to either stay in regional New South Wales for their lives, for jobs, they can. If they want to relocate there from cities like Sydney, they'll be encouraged to, because that will give us an opportunity to get on top of, hopefully get on top of the infrastructure challenges we have in the city, and try and ensure that those growth pains that we've all been experiencing, that are felt every morning and night as people jump on trains, jump on roads to get to and from work or to and from home, have to put up with.
Premier Philip Parker, Parker Asset Management. As an employer, and certainly on the East Coast versus the West Coast, I think we've got a bit of a different unemployment number. I'm cognizant of the difference between the federal and the state on payroll, but is there anything you can do to push it through to make it not an inhibitor to employ, but actually an encouragement to employ people?
You know, our two significant taxes, land tax, payroll tax, a tax on employment, a tax on savings, they're both shockers, but until you can find me a fairer revenue-raising deal, which presumably will involve the nation, they are going to stay. What we need to do is make them as competitive as possible. What we need to do is ensure that they don't encourage people to invest in Queensland or to grow jobs in Victoria. And that's why I put on the table payroll tax rebates to help create 100,000 new jobs in New South Wales by rebating that payroll tax to them. We are determined to be a low tax government, but I have to tell you that the challenge we face on the 6th of September is a significant challenge. The black hole is a real financial crisis, confirmed, you know, of all papers, the Telegraph today, by the acting head of Treasury. We have to deliver on the promises we've made to date, which will revolve around payroll tax cuts through rebates. It revolves around incentives to the development sector through abolition of Labor's home buyers tax and also reductions in stamp duty for empty nesters. But ultimately, we want to ensure that our payroll tax, our other taxes, are at least as competitive as those that exist in other states, because we do understand they are an inhibitor to growth, and unless we have growth, we can't receive the broader revenue that helps us to fuel those great public services that people rely upon.
There's a question down the middle there. Oh, there's one down the back. Okay, Andrew, fine. Okay, and then we'll come up here. We find that? Who wants?
Mr. Premier, there seems to be an elephant in the room which has received a lot of publicity recently, but which no one wants to look at. And I'm talking about productivity, multi-factor productivity. And the problem appears to be labour productivity. Whose responsibility is to take leadership about labour productivity, and why isn't it being done?
Well, you know, we are endeavouring to do that. Let me give you a story about productivity and state government. Labor in 2007 put in place a wages policy that guaranteed to the state's public servants a 2.5% increase in salary each year, and amounts over and above that if unions on their behalf entered into voluntary agreements for productivity savings. As I said in my comments, Labor had that policy but failed to follow through. It cost us $900 million. It cost taxpayers $900 million in the failure to deliver those productivity savings. Treasury informed us that if that policy continued in that form, it would cost close to $2 billion over the next 4 years. Now, frankly, that $900 million, that $2 billion, is money that I'd prefer to invest in the sorts of economic infrastructure that could help the state's economy grow, that could help lift productivity across the board. So, you know, we are determined to lift productivity. We're putting in place incentives to lift productivity, and what we've removed are disincentives to productivity growth, including a policy that saw the state spending millions of dollars each year on public servants whose jobs had been abolished, in one case, whose job had been abolished in 1995.
Mr. Premier, would you consider a poet laureateship for New South Wales? The City of Sydney's appointed a poet laureate.
Well, can I break the bad news to you? The City of Sydney poet is actually funded in part by the state government. And I can't repeat in this room the language I used when I saw the release. All I can say in my defence is that it was an agreement entered into by the former government that my enthusiastic arts minister was simply honouring, and it's been matched, if not leveraged by UDS. I enjoy Australian history. My dad loved Henry Lawson. I used to once be able to recite every verse and every line of The Man from Snow River. I haven't had time lately to refresh myself. So
you're not a candidate?
No, but I reckon we could get some blank verse from a person I know well, so...
Question down here. Yeah, go. Thank you, Mr. Premier. Question down here.
Mr. Premier, government bonds seem to have disappeared. They raised revenue and were good investments. Is there any consideration being given to them?
Indeed. In January 2009, Mike Baird proposed what he termed Waratah bonds should be issued to assist in overcoming infrastructure backlog in the state. So we've committed ourselves to fund our infrastructure mountain through three sources. Firstly, whatever windfall receipts are received by state government, and over the first dozen years of the Labor Party, that was close to $9 billion. $9 billion it should have been set aside because it was like a Tats Lotto or a Lotto winner. It was money that you weren't counting on. It should have been put aside and invested into infrastructure. Secondly, through better realisation of assets, and we announced during the campaign that we're going to lease the desal plant. Wouldn't affect the supply of water, wouldn't affect the price of water, but could free up money to go into our infrastructure fund. And thirdly, through responsible borrowings. Now, those responsible borrowings within the AAA credit rating can be in the usual fashion, or as Mike Baird has argued, as you'll see outlined, Waratah bonds. It will enable mum and dad investors, as well as others, to get a government rate of return, but know they're also doing something to help overcome the state's infrastructure backlog.
Tony Coulter-Smith, Premier. The former previous government made an absolute mess of long-term infrastructure projects, roads, rails, etc., etc., and it's an embarrassing state to live in when you go to other states. Now, you've already got a massive deficit in front of you. How are you going to turn that around, particularly when, with respect, a government's a four-term period, and...
Four-year period.
And you've got to be able to get on and show some results. But many of these projects can't get much done in the first 4 years.
Well, later this week we're having an industry forum in relation to our plans for a new convention and exhibition facilities for Sydney on the space of the existing entertainment centre and the car park behind it. All going well, next year we'll have expressions of interest and a tender process, which, if everything else goes well, the plan is to try and have that facility opened in 2015. Now, that just underscores the delay in getting things built, because 2015 is critical, because we'd like to host the IMF and World Bank regional conferences, world conferences, to be here in Sydney, which would bring huge numbers of people to this city and again provide great economic input. Infrastructure New South Wales is the vehicle that's going to do it for us. I'm criticised at times, for instance, in wanting to do a feasibility study first before, for instance, committing to light rail out to the eastern suburbs. There's 500 million reasons why you should all encourage us to undertake such feasibility studies. It's the $500 million you're paying for the two-stop Rozelle Metro that Labor pressed ahead with great haste for political purposes, not a centimetre of track built, but a $500 million debt to taxpayers. So for all those people who say, just make the decision and get on with it, I say, look at the Rozelle Metro. We want to be a government that does its homework. We want to be a government that designs projects not on the backs of envelopes, but in detail. We want to be a government that will never again miss out on funding from Infrastructure Australia when this city has the biggest infrastructure problems in Australia. You know, we are 20% of the national population. When Infrastructure Australia did its first round of funding, back when the federal government had a surplus left to them by the former government, we got 2% of that because we couldn't put a submission in that argued the economic case that gave the federal government confidence that it was that the projects were properly planned or would be delivered on time and on budget. And that's what Infrastructure New South Wales is about doing, putting rigour, process and certainty back into infrastructure delivery.
Premier, can you give us an update on what are the developments ongoing with the dispute between the state and the federal government over rail, roads, whatever, to the northwest of Sydney in terms of getting better public transport the way it should be? And for everyone who bags Sydney against Melbourne, and I'm an ex-Melburnian, I think the city of Sydney's got just about everything it needs, and it's time the western suburbs and the northwestern suburbs got something too.
Well, it's time we matched, as in JJ Bradfield's day, governments did, infrastructure to population growth. So the northwest, the southwest were identified by the former Labor government a decade ago as our growth regions. Populations the size of Canberra to be relocated to both. Half of them are there in the northwest sector. They're on their way in the southwest sector. Rail lines promised to both. The Northwest Rail Link was to be opened last year and give those people who currently do the M7, M2, Gore Hill Bridge or tunnel commute each day and four tolls or three tolls some relief, some real public transport access. So we are determined to complete the South West Rail Line. I was out there with Gladys. I'm only talking to Gladys a few weeks ago, and and Gladys has got on with the job in relation to the North West Rail Link. We are continuing to talk to the federal government about funding the North West Rail instead of the Parramatta Rail Line, not because we don't believe that Epping to Parramatta is not a good project. It is. But we have to prioritise. We can't overcome the infrastructure backlog all at once. No one's given me a magic wand with the job of Premier. I don't look good in a tutu either. But we need to prioritise. So I'm happy for it to be the third project, but the federal government has to find a way to get itself off the hook of a very New South Wales political decision it took in the last few weeks of that federal campaign when it too, on the back of an envelope, announced a project for base political reasons rather than setting aside and saying what project is going to deliver the most relief to Sydney, because on that basis, it's the North West Rail Link.
Anthony Albanese was at the Institute last Tuesday, and he was pretty emphatic that the government's priority was Epping to Parramatta.
And that's the dilemma we have, but it's a dilemma that I'm not giving up on, and as I say, I'm seeing the Prime Minister on the 15th of July again. But you know, there has to be a way through this, because the other nonsense about the Parramatta to Epping Rail Link, and only a Labor government, state Labor government, fall for this, was that under the promise of funding, New South Wales gets nothing for 4 years until the money starts to come through. We have to spend, I think, $500 million before any money comes through. And, of course, what I remember is that what I knew at the time is that there's another federal election before that promise rolls around.
Mr. Premier, we hear a lot about deficits as an issue in the developed world, in America, in Europe, in Australia in particular. How are governments of all levels in the developed world going to deal with deficits given the demographic issues that we do face, that people of my generation face?
Well, you know, and I know this may even in this room create controversy, I just make the point that no one did more to examine the demographic challenges facing Australia than Peter Costello when he was Treasurer. And when Peter Costello stopped being Treasurer, he left, you know, almost a $20 billion surplus in government, a surplus that, you know, was thankfully used to get us through the GFC, but now looks like a distant memory. So you can face those demographic challenges and still have budget discipline and still deliver the best possible budget outcomes for people. So I don't think there's anything that says that you can't face an ageing population as we have for some time and not deliver proper and budgeting in the black. One of the reasons I'm a supporter of immigration is that the average age of immigrants to this country is helping to lower the average age across this country. What I know, though, is economically the only way in which we survive is to grow the state's economy. The only way, you know, if we kept pace with Victoria over the past 16 years in terms of economic growth,
And it won't surprise you to know that we're at the bottom of the table compared to Victoria. Our economy would be, I think, $12 billion bigger a year annually, and we'd have something like $7 billion in extra revenues. Now, that's money that can help deliver improved services. It's money that can be used to help pay interest on loans for infrastructure funding that's required, but it's money that we missed out on because we lost sight of the question I got at the back about the importance of economic growth, the importance of employment, the importance of keeping taxes low to grow an economy.
So getting close to the end. There's a question down the back. We've got to be very quick. Yes.
Mr. Premier, you just said that you were not in favour of the carbon tax. What would be your ideas about the reduction of greenhouse gases in New South Wales?
Well, I think government can lead by examples, but I'm not going to support a tax that is going to put up prices on average families, that is going to hurt the state's economy by disadvantaging manufacturing. I don't understand if being trickled out, people are going to be compensated for the carbon tax. What's the point of doing it? Because the one thing that I know as a former bureaucrat is that every time government handles money, it requires additional people to be involved, and what I know is that those people cost real dollars. To quote Michael Egan, the state's industrial commission added $500 million to the state's payroll when he was treasurer by simply giving over and above rates of inflation pay increases. So I think there are things that we should be doing. We should be encouraging people to engage in good behaviour. We should be ensuring that governments, for instance, engage in good behaviour. It always used to amuse me that only in recent years, if I can be so impolite as this example, Gerard, that Parliament House got double flush toilets. A building that was renovated in 1982, but only in the last year or two, despite a 10-year or so drought, started to get serious about water efficiency. The same can be done with energy efficiency as well. I think we need to start focusing on the demand side as opposed to the pricing side of the debate.
Just a final question. I know you're not Lord Mayor of Sydney, but
no aspirations. I don't look good in the collar.
Not Poet Laureate, not Lord Mayor of Sydney. You're under-aspiring. But if you travel, as you know, if you travel around inner Sydney where the roads are choked anyways, you find increasing number of bicycle tracks with no bicycles on them, but with cars queuing up. This is a problem for Australia's major city. It doesn't happen in any other city. I mean, can you do anything about this, the problem of making our congested roads even more congested?
Well, you could have delivered bike lanes to this city without making the major routes into the city worse. So, Gerard, I'm happy for people to ride their bikes to the city. I'm happy for people to walk to the city. I'm happy for people to use a pogo stick to come to the city if they want to. Public transport brings a lot of people to this city, but of course there's not unlimited capacity on public transport, and there's 600,000 people a day who visit or work in this city, and the great bulk of them, 90% plus, are not voters in the City of Sydney Council elections. So we need to understand that as much as Clover Moore is seeking to do the right thing in encouraging safe cycling into the city, it also comes with an agenda to prevent cars coming into the city. I think, if I'm allowed to use this analogy, we could have had our cake and eat it too. We could have put bike lanes on roads that weren't as important to traversing the city as, for instance, College Street is, and still provided the safe traffic, safe routes for the cyclists and not infuriated the traffic drivers. Gerard, Clover Moore and I are in conversation. You wouldn't necessarily believe that if you were the tabloids, but we are in conversation about how to do these things better. We're not at loggerheads. I have no desire to sack the Sydney City Council. We want to work with governments of all levels to deliver better outcomes, and we're determined in relation to the City of Sydney to stand up for those people that come into this city who don't get to vote in local council elections and who increasingly, because of problems with transport or growth of transport patronage, do so either by bus or by car, both of which are affected by these bike lanes.
Many thanks. Just stand there for a second and I'll be very brief. Barry O'Farrell's been a member of the Sydney Institute since he came to Sydney some years ago, and
He first spoke here in 1999 and the topic was rebuilding the New South Wales Liberals. And I don't think anyone who came to that function, which from memory was at BT and Chifley Tao, would have thought that just over a decade later he achieved the task of not only rebuilding the Liberals but bringing the Liberals to government in a coalition with the National Party, a very successful coalition. And as Mr. O'Farrell's demonstrated again tonight, he has a great grasp of history. He's very well read, but also a great grasp of detail. It's 100 years since election night.
100 days.
Sorry.
It feels like 100 years sometimes.
I always bring along a fact checker. 100 days since election night. It's been a very busy time. We're very grateful you found time to come to the Sydney Institute tonight. I'm sure you'll be back again in the future, but for tonight, well done and thank you.
Can I have uncharacteristically have the last word? If there is part of a 100-day plan that is unwritten, and I know I've been accused in some parts of this city as implementing non-written 100-day plans, it's that the Blues win on Wednesday night, win the series.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.